Well, good morning. Good to see you all here today. So good to have the Whitakers with us. We've tried to make them comfortable with the weather. Well, I know sometimes things get reversed and it's not nearly as bad in Canada as we think it is. But we've certainly had a little blast of winter here. Those of you that enjoy the snow, I'm sure happy. And those of us that have to work in it are surviving. But we can be happy in spite of the weather, can't we? We have Jesus in our heart. Well, we've been studying in Isaiah, and this morning we're going to proceed in that direction. Isaiah 20. This is a bit of a shocking passage in many ways, but it was a shocking time. So, here in Isaiah 20, we read, "In the year that the commander-in-chief who was sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod and fought against it and captured it, at that time, the Lord spoke by Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying." Now, I'm going to pause just a moment here. I'm reading from the ESV this morning. And this is one of those times where you really miss something if you don't see the King James. The King James says, "In the year that Tartan came to Ashdod." And if you have been exposed to the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, you probably might be thinking, I wonder if Lewis got his name for the group of people to the south of Narnia and the name of their commanders from this. They were Tarkons, right? Instead of Tartans. Could be, I don't know. Has anybody read anything about that, where he got his names from? He certainly draws from a number of images that seem to come from the Middle East in describing those people. They're dark. They have curved swords and mighty horses. So, could be. So, I just wanted to share that with you. I know some of you are lovers of the Chronicles of Narnia. But Isaiah, in many respects, is easier to follow in other than the King James, so that's why I'm reading here. So in verse 2, we then get to what the Lord spoke unto Isaiah. He says, "Go and loose the sackcloth from your waist and take off your sandals from your feet." And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, "As my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Cush," or Ethiopia, "so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptian captives and the Cushite exiles, both the young and the old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered, the nakedness of Egypt. Then they shall be dismayed and ashamed because of Cush, their hope, and of Egypt, their boast. And the inhabitants of this coastland will say in that day, 'Behold, this is what has happened to those in whom we hoped, and to whom we fled for help, to be delivered from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape?'" Okay, so whenever Isaiah was commissioned in the earlier part of the book, chapter 6, wasn't it? We had that interaction between him and God, or the voice that said, "Whom will we send? And Isaiah says, "Here am I, send me." He was signing up for more than he probably thought at the time. He didn't know what all God was going to ask him to do. But the picture here, of course, is one which communicates in a very vivid fashion the coming shame which will come to the Egyptians who are trying to gather together allies against the Assyrians at this time. In the ancient world, it was a shame to run around naked. There's more than one way that the old-fashioned days are better, and that's one of them. A lot of people don't realize anymore that it's a shame to run around naked or nearly so. But that was the case here. The captives were typically stripped of everything they had, and they were led away barefoot and naked. And so Isaiah's message was, this is what's going to happen to those that trust in the Egyptians, because that's what's going to happen to them. And of course, the big issue here was, do we join together with this offer? The Egyptians basically were peddling an offer of security. If you'll join us, we can... Well, it was more like this. If you'll rise up against the Assyrians, we'll back you up. It's just that when it happened, they didn't end up being there. But Isaiah was very intent on keeping the leadership of Jerusalem from going down this route, because it was a dead end. There's some interesting stuff here in the commentary I've been reading that I want to share with you to help you have a better picture of the history and the context of all this, as well as the function that this chapter plays in Isaiah's bigger scheme. Because this is the book that we're studying is mostly a collection of his burdens, his prophecies against various people and about things to come, and yet we have this little snippet of history in the middle here. You know, why did he include this in this? How does this function in the bigger picture of what he's trying to do? And also, it's a contrast from what we just read last week. You remember last week, Isaiah looks far into the future and sees a time when Egypt will even be united with Syria and the land of the Jews in worshiping the one true God. And so now we've gone back away from that picture into a very different picture here. And so we read here that the Assyrian campaign against Ashdod took place in 711. Okay, Ashdod. Ashdod was one of the main cities of the Philistines, and it was located not quite to the coast. Here's Jerusalem here, and the land of the Philistines here, and so Ashdod was one of their main cities. You remember that Samaria fell to the Assyrians in 722, and so this is 11 years later, 711, that after Ashdod rebelled, the Assyrians engaged in a campaign against it. For the previous 4 years, Egypt had been unsettling the western Palestinian states with promises of aid should they rise up against Assyria. By 713, Ashdod was in rebellion. As a consequence, Assyria deposed its king and put another in his place. But Ashdod was not to be deterred. The new king was ousted, and envoys were sent to call Judah, Edom, and Moab to join the rising. Since Hezekiah, suffered no Assyrian reprisals at this time, he probably held aloof. It could even be that he was swayed by Isaiah's views, as expressed in chapter 18. But Ashdod did not escape. Sargon II, now at the height of his power, sent his supreme commander. Ashdod was reduced and became an Assyrian province. Egypt, true to form, reneged on its promises. At some time in all this, Isaiah initiated an act, an acted oracle, that is, by going about stripped and barefooted. His intention in miming the plight of captive was to expose the futility of trusting Egypt. When this fate came upon Egypt before his audience's very eyes, they would realize the hopelessness of the policy they had adopted. Such was the historical setting of Isaiah's acted oracle. He visibly committed himself to the veracity, that is, the truth, of the word given to him, and they would see it fulfilled. So, the question, why does this get included in this collection of his works? In chapter 19, which we read last week, he's been outlining a worldwide hope in which three nations of his own day have figured. His own people, the imperial Assyria, and the would-be imperial Egypt. His vision for them has been outstanding. The two superpowers would be joined to tiny Judah as one people in one world under one God. Is this credible? To prove that it is, Isaiah records an incident showing that precisely these world empires, in the heyday of their power, are subject to the word of the Lord. Nothing, therefore, is impossible. It is of significance. What is of significance is not a human estimate of what can happen, but that the Lord has spoken. Okay, so it seems that the understanding here that as Isaiah has prophesied a coming time whenever these great powers will be united in serving the one God, which is, you can imagine, a seemingly outrageous claim. How can that possibly be? That's like suggesting that the Chinese and the Russians will become Christians. How could that possibly be? And so Isaiah says, well, God says it's going to be. That's how it can possibly be. And just as God has said that, God has predicted the coming failure of the Egyptians to rise up against the Assyrians. And he has commanded me to, shall we say, graphically demonstrate what he has predicted in this way. And so as unsettling, as jarring as this kind of prophecy would be, this kind of acted out prophecy, it adds credibility to all of what Isaiah has proclaimed that the Lord has spoken, because they can see, in fact, this is what happens. So, fortunately, God doesn't often command his people to act out oracles like that. But Isaiah felt like this was what he must do. This is what God had commanded him to do. One more comment about that, as to whether, in fact, that actually is what's being communicated here. Sackcloth was apparently Isaiah's normal wear. Was it the sackcloth of mourning or the rough garment worn by prophets? Unanswered question. Stripped is literally naked. Did Isaiah really go naked? Or is the NIV correct in safeguarding the proprieties with stripped? The general use of the word, the Hebrew word, arom, suggests the former. Come what may, he paid the price of obedience by embodying the word he was given.
something about stripped to the waist.
You did. Where did you see that?
Verse 2.
What verse?
Go and loosen the sackcloth from your hips.
From verses 2. Not to be overly graphic, but of course, if that was true, he wouldn't have bare buttocks, which is part of the shame. Lars just getting the shock of this.
Africans, maybe, or something. Maybe not. Okay. And if it's compared to what they do to slaves, I mean, I guess that I understand that that would be very humiliating.
Yeah.
Yes, it's hard.
Well, you know, God uses prophets as object lessons all the time. I mean, look at Ezekiel. I mean, he had to lay 390 days on his left side to show the iniquity and the siege of the northern kingdom. And 40 days on his right side to show the iniquity of Judah. I mean, that's over a year of laying on your side in front of everybody, you know, laying siege to a brick.
That's
kind of embarrassing.
That's a surrendered will.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, there's an object lesson.
Yeah.
Yes. The consequences of being stiff-necked are only detrimental to those that are, but also to those who are sent to communicate to them. Anyway, quite a, like I said earlier, a shocking passage. But I think we should focus not so much on the details of the passage, but on the point that Isaiah seems to feel like that this demonstrates that what God says will come to pass. His word is in control of things and not what you think is likely to happen or might happen. And, I mean, we live in days, I think, where we should have a little bit of a grasp on how quickly and how vastly things can change on a worldwide level. I mean, if you would have told any of us 3 years ago that we would be facing the kind of issues that we have in the last 2 years, we'd have said, what? There's no way. And then to say that it would be worldwide? No, maybe in some communist country, you know, some dictatorship, but everywhere? In America? Well, we've seen it, haven't we? Things can happen fast. And Isaiah would tell us that your only security is faith in the Lord of hosts, the one true God, who is faithful in spite of the things that change around you. Okay. So then, this was a short chapter. We'll move on. Now, we've noted that this general section of Isaiah that we're looking at is composed of two sets of five oracles. And the first set involve oracles which are addressed to specific named entities. Damascus, Babylon, Moab, and so forth. The second set are a little more cryptic and yet identifiable in their object. Isaiah continues to build oracles from many different points of origin into a mosaic worldview. The first cycle that I talked about is marked by buoyant certainty. The world is in the Lord's hands, and his promises will be fulfilled. The second cycle, starting with chapter 21, offers a complete contrast. It begins with a vision of judgment from which Isaiah recoils in horror and proceeds to a lone voice in the darkness and a prediction of darkness yet to come. It reveals a Gentile world seeking but not finding help and accuses the people of God of an unforgivable sin in chapter 22. Its one note of hope is a tribute to the Lord from Tyre, the city of Tyre. But even this is at the end of an oracle of destruction. Thus, as Isaiah probes forward into the future, he sees the world becoming darker. History does not, every day, in every way, become better and better. Divine judgments become starker, needs become deeper and more insoluble. The people of God are beset by a spirit of self-sufficiency and this worldliness. Isaiah is not departing from his confidence in the promises of God, but he is relating them realistically to ever more desperate situations as time goes on. In this series, this second five oracles, Isaiah uses cryptic titles for four of the five oracles. In each case, the oracle can, in fact, be identified with a place, but the cryptic element in the title means, as we shall see, that the place in question is not considered as a historical entity, but as the embodiment of a topic or principle. So it's not so much what this particular place will have happened to it at a particular time, but it's more using this place as representative of issues and principles and the kind of results that will happen in general. First one is termed the desert by the sea. And this seems to be clearly referring to Babylon once again. Babylon was also referenced specifically in the first five, you might remember. Now, a little bit of discussion here. As I've mentioned earlier, one of the things that I love about the commentator that we are looking at here, Alec Moitcher, who is contemporary with us, he just died in the last few years, is that he reads Isaiah in great detail and with great skill, and reads him as though it was all written by Isaiah, one Isaiah. Unfortunately, in the last couple centuries, scholarship in general has tended to divide Isaiah up into pieces. You have Deutero-Isaiah and Third Isaiah that those that are skilled in that kind of analysis can tell you they realize that it wasn't all written by one man. Alex says there's absolutely no reason to do that. The one thing that is universally true about the people that do is they don't agree with each other about which parts are which. And so if it's so clear that that's what it was, there should be some agreement about how that works. And so, some, for instance, of these things that Isaiah talks about, the basis on which they are proclaimed to be of later origin is that they are tied to later historic events. So they'll talk about the fall of Babylon. It's like, oh, that's this fall of Babylon. Well, something that we'll see in this next little bit we read is that Babylon fell many times. And so there's no need immediately to say that it is of a later date. And of course, as we've mentioned before, one of the most basic reasons that some scholars refuse to think that it was one Isaiah is that Isaiah very clearly predicts things that would have been in his future. And that's just not possible. Okay, so some commentary about this particular oracle then in regard to those things. The reference in Babylon to Babylon in verse 9 is usually thought to determine the date to which this oracle refers. The city's fall to Cyrus in 539. Okay, so this would have been long after Isaiah's time. Isaiah was prophesying in the 700s. It's really weird when you number stuff backwards. So when you say early 600s, do you mean low numbers or early time, right? Anyway, he prophesied into the 600s, whether you would call that early or late, I'm not sure. But certainly he was no longer alive by the time that Babylon fell during the time of Daniel and Belshazzar. In consequence, the composition of the oracle is dated to some, in some approximately to that event. Or by some. This view is supported by the reference to the Medes in verse 2, who were associated with the Persians in conquering Babylon. The careless revelry of verse 5 also suits what is known of Babylon at the moment of its fall. But things are not quite so clear-cut. Okay, so we're talking about this passage and we haven't read it yet. So let us go ahead and read the text here from Isaiah in chapter 21. And quite frankly, it doesn't read easy. That is to say, you don't go through it once and say, oh yeah, I know what that means. Clearly. But it goes like this. The oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea, as whirlwinds in the Negeb sweep on. Okay, and so this, sometimes that's spelled Negev, refers to the desert to the south of the land of Israel. So, as whirlwinds in this desert land sweep on, it comes from the wilderness, from a terrible land. A stern vision is told to me. The traitor betrays, the destroyer destroys. Go up, O Elam, lay siege, O Media. All the signs she has caused I bring to an end. Therefore my loins are filled with anguish. Pangs have seized me like the pangs of a woman in labor. I am bowed down so that I cannot hear. I am dismayed so that I cannot see. My heart staggers. Horror has appalled me. The twilight I long for has been turned for me into trembling. They prepare the table. They spread the rugs. They eat. They drink. Arise, O princes, oil the shield. For thus the Lord said to me, go set a watchman. Let him announce what he sees. When he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, riders on donkeys, riders on camels, let him listen diligently, very diligently. Then he who saw cried out, quote, upon a watchtower I stand, O Lord, continually by day, and at my post I am stationed whole nights. And behold, there are riders, horsemen, and pairs. And he answered, fallen, fallen is Babylon, and all the carved images of her gods he has shattered to the ground. O my threshed and winnowed one, what I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I announce to you. Okay, that's the oracle. Now, everybody go home and write a 2-page paper about what you understand there. Well, there are some intense images and metaphors strung together there. At first glance, it's not clear at all what's going on in Isaiah's mind. Now, something that is helpful to some extent is at some point as we're reading through Isaiah here, you want to read the accounts in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles that relate the history of the Jewish nation during that period, because that can sometimes be of help in illuminating the background. This particular oracle seems to have come from the period of Hezekiah's reign. And I think I will just jump over to 2 Kings and bring to your mind a little bit about Hezekiah. Hezekiah was the son of Ahaz, and of course we have heard his name mentioned in Isaiah already. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And we even have his mother's name. What I miss about the King James, of course, is that all the aids, language aids, are there. And so I was wanting to know about this lady's name, whether that was a long I or how to pronounce it. So I was like, this may be where we get our word Abby, name Abby. That was Hezekiah's mother. Anyway, verse 3, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. And you know, when you read that in Kings, you just sort of breathe easy for a minute because it doesn't happen all that often. And it's a really refreshing thing. Hezekiah did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places. Okay, which is a reference to where the pagan gods were worshipped, and break the images, and cut down the groves, and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it. And he called it Nehushtan, which means a thing of brass. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. Okay, and so don't take that to extremes. Obviously, he was somewhat like David, because we've already been told that. He served the Lord like David. But given his circumstances and the kind of changes he made, there was none quite like him, although his I guess it'd be his grandson, Josiah, was very similar in his revival of serving God. For he clave to the Lord and departed not from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him, and he prospered whithersoever he went forth. And he rebelled against the king of Assyria and served him not. He smote the Philistines, even unto Gaza, and the borders thereof, from the tower of the watchman to the fenced city. And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. At the end of 3 years he took it, even in the sixth year of Hezekiah. And actually, it was the final conquest of Samaria occurred under Shalmaneser's successor, Sargon. Anyway, it goes into some more details there, which you can read about events during his day. However, even though Hezekiah did rebel against the king of Assyria, he ended up paying tribute to the king of Assyria later in his reign. So he wasn't able to totally maintain his independence, but kept his throne, and the city wasn't taken by the Assyrians. And that's all I'm going to read right now. There's quite an interesting account there about how the Assyrians threatened Jerusalem, but were defeated through divine intervention. So Hezekiah seems to be the backdrop, that is to say, his time, his reign, for this oracle that we're reading in chapter 21 of Isaiah. Okay, so as I mentioned, because of the things that are said there in chapter 21, some scholars would say, oh yes, this is talking about the fall of Babylon in 539. Alex says, not quite so quick. First of all, verses 1 through 2a suggest a familiarity with weather conditions in the Negev, and therefore a Palestinian rather than a Babylonian location for the author. Okay, so think about it. If an author uses a metaphor that describes a part of the world that he's never been in before, what's the likelihood of that? You tend to describe things based on your experiences, where you've been. Babylon is a long ways from the land of Israel. And so the point here, somebody who is analyzing this text would say, okay, this was probably somebody who's, is definitely somebody who's familiar with the land of Israel, because he uses a metaphor that comes from the events that occur there, the whirlwinds out of the desert. Second, the activities of Elam and Media, who are countries to the east in general, Elam's a little south too, of Babylon, they cannot be restricted to the fall of Babylon in 539. They were on and off stage all through the Assyrian and Babylonian periods. Number three, there is no reason why the fall of Babylon to Persia should be a matter of anguish to the prophet and a dire vision to be reported to the crushed people of God. Okay, so it doesn't make any sense that Isaiah would have been impacted in this way to something like the fall in 539. The fall of Babylon in 539 was a non-violent one, essentially. The Medes and Persians didn't destroy the city. They took it unawares. As I remember, so Babylon, the river Euphrates flows through it, and so there was a defensive structure on the upstream side that prevented people from getting in by way of the river. Well, the Medes and the Persians went upstream and diverted the river so that the water dropped and they were able to walk under those defenses. So they basically walked in and didn't have to destroy the city. So another reason why there's no need to say that it's 539 that he's talking about. Four. Careless eating and drinking from verse 5 is found also in chapter 22. And it's a motif for the complacent and blinkered spirit of Jerusalem. It is suitable to Babylon on the night of its fall, that it is, could be no more than coincidental. Number five, the fall of Babylon in 539 was only one of the many endured by the city and has no prescriptive right to be the one referred to here. It fell to Sargon II in 710, to Sennacherib in 702 and 689, and to Ashurbanipal in 648. Throughout this period, Elam and Media were involved, but on Babylon's side. The call to arms in verse 2 does not have to refer to Cyrus's attack in 539. An entirely different scenario is possible and preferable. Another commentator argues persuasively that this oracle relates to the fall of Babylon in 689. And we actually talked about that earlier. Which certainly for ferocity matched what Isaiah forecast. Sennacherib records that he filled the city with corpses. Quote, the gods dwelling therein, the hands of my people took them and smashed them. The buildings and walls were destroyed, and his final gesture was to have huge volumes of water released over the ruins to obliterate every trace of that city, which had been constantly in revolt. The whole oracle can be understood from this perspective. The key is the ever-restless figure of Merodach-Baladan. Okay, so this is an individual who comes into the Hezekiah story in one of the later passages that we read. He was a leader in Babylon from 722 to 710, and then again 705 to 702. And when he came to Jerusalem to offer his condolences for Hezekiah's illness, Hezekiah was totally taken in by him and showed him all of the treasures of the kingdom, showed him the temple, showed him everything. And we have the account then of Isaiah rebuking Hezekiah for doing this, in spite of the fact that he religiously had restored the worship of God to its true form, he didn't always have wisdom. And when Isaiah announced to him the coming destruction of the kingdom, Hezekiah's biggest concern was that, well, it's not going to happen during my time. So, it's not a big deal. So, a sad way to reflect on certainly the future. I think all of us would agree we care very much about what happens to our kids and our offspring, those that survive us. It's not just about, is it okay for me? But what about the long range? What about the future? Then Alex says this particular oracle needs to be understood in that framework. So there's a lot of details here, and I hate to feel like we're just slogging through them because it takes a while to get used to them, but let me show you some changes, some transitions in the oracle that are instances of the way that Isaiah changes perspective. He'll give a picture, he'll give an image, he'll give a metaphor, and then he will change. So here between verse 4 and verse 5, verse 4 says, my heart staggers, horror has appalled me. The twilight I long for has turned for me into trembling. So this is how the oracle affected him. Then verse 5 says, they prepare the table, they spread the rugs, they eat, they drink. Arise, O princes, oil the shield. That's clearly in a totally different mindset. And this seems to be his description of the reception of Baladan by Hezekiah. So when he came, he was feasted. He was they treated him like a great man from a noble country that they were looking to form an alliance with against the Assyrians. And so this communicates some of the details of the process of preparing for this feast and preparing as well to battle, oil the shield. There's an interesting story behind this next image. He talks about when he sees riders, horsemen in pairs, riding on donkeys and riding on camels. It seems that one of the customs of war that the ancient Arabs had was when they went into battle, they would ride a mount and they would lead another mount. The one they were leading was actually their best mount, so that if things went bad for them, they could get on it and get away. It was the faster one was the one that, not the one they rode into battle, but the one they were leading. And so then when we get down to this report of what the watchman saw, he said, "And behold, there come riders, horsemen in pairs," which indicates that they've been successful in battle because they're still leading the best one. They're not running the other way.
So each one would have two.
Yeah. Which seems kind of cumbersome, but anyway. A little detail, which if you don't know, this actually has no intelligibility at all. You know, what are we talking about here? What's the point? And yet it actually communicates something specific.
What about the riders on donkeys and camels?
Well, it's not limited to horses. They didn't. Whatever beast of burden happened to be used by these people. It gets covered. The point here then for Isaiah is this increasing picture of failure by the Gentile world to overcome their difficulties by these various groupings, these alliances that they tend to have. So we saw in the last oracle the Egyptians trying to gain support for their alliance against the Assyrians. Here we have Babylon, likewise, and this particular picture is that of failure, that they fail in this effort. And Isaiah would say to Hezekiah, don't look to join these alliances. Don't look for security to these other nations, but keep your security and your faith in God. And so in many ways, this is another passage which is fairly inaccessible to us unless we spend some time with it and sort of delve into the history and the images that Isaiah is dealing with here. But surely we can appreciate his message of reliance on God. Well, we are out of time, so I'm going to stop there. I'm sure the bell will ring momentarily. Thank you.
can I say thanks for the things you have done for me? Things so undeserved, yet you give to prove your and should I give